From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Georgia Public Media Studios in Macon. It's nice to be back in Macon, Georgia. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, just like you. And we are very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, May 31 is the Orthodox Christian celebration of Pentecost, while Christians mark Trinity Sunday. Sundown brings the start of the Muslim observance of Lailat al-Bara, and Thursday will bring the Catholic feast of Corpus Christi. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief radio show.
Josh Duggar, now 27 and the oldest of the children on the TLC show, had sexually abused several girls when he was a teenager, and his parents didn't report it for some time.
When Jim Bob Duggar, his dad, ran for U.S. Senate back in 2002, he did explain his position on incest, and he called for the death penalty.
I'm sure you weren't able to avoid the distasteful reports of scandal swirling around the reality TV stars, the Duggar family, this week. There's nothing to be gained from further sensationalizing the molestation charges against the family's oldest son, Josh. But with the now suspended TLC TV program, 19 Kids and Counting, modeling a particular kind of fundamentalist Christian approach to raising children and participating in society, it is important to take this moment to consider the special risk posed by this totalitarian model of family for women and children. Because there are a remarkable number of Americans living in this world right now, less visible than they otherwise would be due to homeschooling and other isolating practices. It's often referred to as the quiverful model of family. And for a serious look at these risks, I'll talk once again to Vicki Garrison, who blogs at the Patheos website section called No Longer Quivering.
A new study on the changing U.S. religious landscape shows we are losing our religion. The number of Americans who don't affiliate with a particular religion has grown to approximately 56 million in recent years.
As we continue with our series examining the recent Pew Research findings of ongoing decline in American religiosity, we'll look this week at cultural affiliations that may begin with religious affinity but can go beyond them. I'll be joined by Interfaith Alliance Executive Director Rabbi Jack Moline. But first,
Muslims that support free speech will not be offended. Muslims that want to impose the Sharia will be offended. It's not to be provocative. I did not make the cartoons of Flashpoint. The jihadis made the cartoons of Flashpoint. Right. And if we give up on this point, what is next?
As if the loss of life at her recent Draw Muhammad cartoon contest in Texas weren't enough, perennial anti-Islam crusader Pamela Geller has now announced that she'll be using the winning drawing in her latest advertising campaign on Washington, D.C. public transit. It's not easy to think of a responsible response to this kind of behavior, especially if one hopes the response could have any sort of effect. Just before the Texas shootings, Religion Dispatch's senior correspondent, Haroon Mogul, wrote an extremely thoughtful article on his experience of attending a Geller event in New York City. His words make for incredibly relevant reading in the present situation, and I am so happy to have him back with us on State of Belief Radio. Haroon, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Would you just briefly describe the encounter that you had with Pamela Geller?
Sure. She spoke at Brooklyn College about a week and a half before the attack in Garland, Texas. And what I saw was really indicative to me of what she's doing to conversations about religion and Islam and extremism in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The overwhelming majority of people completely ignored her event. She wasn't hosted by any institution at Brooklyn College. She was privately invited by a professor. There were no university funds that went towards her speech. And the overwhelming majority of Muslim students, as well as other students at Brooklyn College, completely ignored the event. However, a small group of students did go, and the event descended very quickly into a back-and-forth shouting match that got at times very heated, including with people, I think, on both sides, making threats at one another. And I decided I should write about it, and then when the attack happened, I decided it had to be published.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about the inherent limitations to the knee-jerk counter-reaction some of the participants had to Geller.
We've gone through an evolution as an American Muslim community, and I'll tell you what I've been seeing. 10 or 15 years ago, we, unfortunately, a lot of us were not that sophisticated. And many times our response to this kind of provocation and this kind of speech, Pam Geller's type of activities, would usually be some kind of protest. It would be simple, crude, and usually not very effective. If anything, it would produce more attention to the problematic speech. Over time, people started to learn that that's not really very productive because you're giving attention to people who crave and seek and demand attention. Mm-hmm. So the new response became ignore it and ignore her. And that's what we saw happen in Texas, where she had a Draw Muhammad cartoon day. And Dallas, Texas, actually, which is near Garland, is home to about 150,000 Muslims. It's one of the larger Muslim communities in the United States, and it's actually one of the more dynamic Muslim communities in the United States. A lot of American Islam's most famous scholars, religious authority figures, are based there. So it's a hub for Muslim life. And out of all these scholars, all these mosques, all these communities, these tens of thousands of Muslims, not a single one decided to protest or respond to the event. They didn't want to give her any attention. They didn't want to give her the time of day. They didn't even want to exercise their right to free speech. And then this happens, where you have two previously radicalized individuals try to attack the event, and it creates a dilemma because it says to people that even if you walk away, even if organizationally, institutionally, you ignore the provocation, there's always a chance someone somewhere on the margins, a lone wolf, someone who's been radicalized or who's a little bit off or dangerous or violent, is going to do something, and then your entire community is placed into jeopardy. So when I mentioned the inherent limitations, what I was trying to say and hoping to say was that we need to get to a point where we're more proactive. We need to be getting out there and talking to people instead of her. Ignoring her is fine, but I think intelligently responding to some of her arguments without necessarily addressing her is probably the better way to do it. And this combative approach is not helping. And that's what I meant with the Brooklyn College approach, where the majority of Muslim students ignore her, and a few decide to go and argue and debate with her, and it doesn't go anywhere.
As Pamela Geller leverages the tragedy in Texas by using the winning Draw Muhammad cartoon in anti-Islam bus ads in Washington, what's the best way? What's the most effective way of responding?
Well, there's an American Muslim comedian, Dino Baidala, who has a radio show as well, and he's been pretty active in the Muslim community, on the comic circuit, shall we say, for quite some time. And he proposed a set of ads for the subway, which would basically go up and be humorous and talk about different contributions Muslims have made to America and different qualities of Muslims. And he followed that up with a draw your favorite Islamophobe cartoon, which was kind of tongue-in-cheek. But the neatest response I saw was actually from a blog called Muslim Girl, where this young woman proposed draw your relative Muhammad Day. Since Muhammad, as some of your listeners might know, is one of the more popular names in the world, and it sometimes seems like every other person in the Muslim community is named Muhammad, she proposed to draw someone you know named Muhammad Day. So Muhammad's your dad or your cousin or your uncle or your friend or your crush or your husband, what have you. And it was sort of like a goofy tongue-in-cheek way of responding to something very hateful and hurtful without taking away Pamela Geller's right to free speech and, of course, without threatening or engaging in a kind of rhetoric or discourse that can become threatening. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's honestly the best response, is you need some kind of levity, some kind of humor, throw something in there that's a little bit different, a little bit unexpected, maybe make people smile and get them to think a little bit differently about some of the things they hear in the news.
That's a terrific story to tell right now as people are thinking about how to handle their negative emotions on this. I'm curious, Arun, I thought of this when you said it a few moments ago, the change that is taking place in how the Muslim community reacts to Islamophobia, is the progress that's being made in effectively responding to that, is it coming just because people are watching this happen more and getting more ideas of the way they should respond, or are they getting help? I mean, I know you study this all the time, and so I'm not at all surprised that you are seeing more effective ways to respond. But are there lessons being learned throughout the community because there's intentional instruction about how to respond?
A little bit of both. A lot of the problem was really we were a very young community, and in some ways we really are. Most American Muslims, if they've been in the country that long, it's back to the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. American Islam in the modern form that we know today begins with the Nation of Islam, and then you have a wave of immigration in the 1960s and 70s continuing on to today. So you've got these two streams, again, you know, at most 60 or 70 years, and they've had to learn to work with each other and maybe even start to work with each other in recent times. So mm-hmm. a lot of this stuff is new to us. My parents, for example, were doctors. They were great doctors, but they didn't know anything about media. Mm-hmm. I've been in media, but I don't know that much about media necessarily. It's also reasonably new to me. So you build up a reserve of knowledge over time. You learn from your mistakes. And then you learn what other communities are doing, what other communities are facing. There's a mm-hmm. lot of interest among American Muslims at the kind of anti-Semitism, for example, that Jews face and faced in the past, racism, racist language, exclusionary rhetoric, the kind of language around immigration and Latinos. People are paying attention to the ways in which exclusion is practiced in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And seeing if they can draw lessons to their own experience. And in many ways, it's the same kind of language, the same kind of rhetoric, and the same lessons apply.
You describe an evolution in your own responses to hate and provocation. How would you say you have changed? And I guess even more importantly, what were the dynamics fueling your change?
Well, for me, honestly, when I was in college, I was the activist type, and I believed very strongly in a very limited model of activism and engagement. And I didn't really pay much attention to the world around me. And probably the thing that most shaped me is failure. A lot of the causes that I participated in didn't go anywhere. We were banging our heads against the wall. I remember coming out into the streets of thousands of people when the Iraq War was being talked about, thinking this is a terrible idea. And it turned out a lot worse than even I would have feared. And when you see that kind of thing happen and realize that that kind of protest had no effect, that we were completely ignored, it makes you realize that you need to maybe do something different, maybe to talk to people that you wouldn't otherwise talk to. One of the most interesting experiences I had was about a year or two ago when I went to Israel on a program to learn about Judaism in Israel. Mm-hmm. And although obviously I know many people who are Jewish, I had never actually directly engaged with people who describe themselves as Zionists and who are active as Zionists in Jewish community life and Israeli life. And that was a very transformative experience for me because it occurred to me that I had basically placed myself into a silo. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I think we do that where we assume that because something is compelling to us, it will naturally resonate with other people. And we don't realize how other people might have concerns that we are completely ignoring. So I think I'm more aware now of why people fear Islam and the Muslim world and why people think Muslims aren't doing enough or doing anything to combat extremism. And there's a lot of different reasons for that, but I'm definitely more alive to it. And the only reason I am is because many of the causes in which I participated turned out to be failures.
Mm-hmm. Haroon, you're a much sought-after public speaker. When you talk about the anti-Muslim industry in the United States, what do you say about that?
I think a lot of people have a hard time accepting and understanding that American Muslims are American. It's deeply frustrating and oftentimes confusing, but I think I finally figured out why that is. If you watch Fox News, I just did a segment on Fox News 2 days ago, pretty much every single Muslim they bring on is either an extremist or someone who's a former Muslim or with an uncertain relationship to the community who is saying that Muslims don't condemn extremism. So you only really ever hear from two kinds of Muslims, namely the Muslims who are extremists or the Muslims who are saying that Muslims don't condemn extremism. So if that's your primary news source, if that's what you're listening to and hearing, then your assumption is that American Muslims are no different than ISIS. And to me, that's endlessly disturbing and fascinating. When I write on Islamophobia, the kind of hate mail I receive, and you notice escalating as your audience increases in size, is simply phenomenal. I've talked to many journalists who aren't Muslim, including journalists who are Jewish, for example, Christian, who say that the minute they mention Islamophobia, the kind of hate mail and threats and harassment they receive is simply shattering. Mm-hmm. And that's a reality. And that's a sad fact, that an American community that has very American concerns and priorities and maps out like almost any other American community is assumed to be not just a foreign body, but a hostile body.
Mm-hmm. Haroon, when you look at what happened in Texas, my sense is that Pamela Geller got what she wanted. The two attackers got what they wanted. But we lost a moment when there could have been a step forward in trying to do away with what both sides wanted there. Is that a fair assessment?
To be honest with you, I was surprised by the response. I think a lot of people recognize the dangers of Pamela Geller's approach, by no means excusing or playing down the threat of violence and the fact that that's completely unacceptable. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, even on the right, really were disturbed by what they saw she was doing. Geraldo Rivera had a great little monologue on Fox News where he pointed out that no other community is treated in this way. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but it was an impassioned moment, and it was interesting to see it coming from the right. Donald Trump as well, another figure who I never imagined I'd be retweeting, was saying precisely the same thing, that this is insightful. And the argument I use to people is, you have a right, for example, to go into a neighborhood, let's say in Baltimore, after the riots and wave a Confederate flag. But why would you do that? Mm-hmm. What is the point of doing that? And what do you hope to draw out of it? And if you get violence out of it, what are you really contributing to any kind of conversation? And I think the problem is that Pamela Geller is using one kind of freedom, namely freedom of speech, in order to basically take away other freedoms, right? The only way democracy works is if you use your freedoms with responsibility. And that's nothing the government can or should ever try to enforce, or we should try to force on other people. It comes from some kind of internal compass, some kind of internal morality. And if we're using freedom of speech to incite people, then that becomes a problem. And the way to respond to that is by not allowing yourself to get into that kind of conversation, because then you're giving her what she wants. So I think in a perverse sense, she got what she wanted, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But we also learned something greater, which is that for American Muslims, it was very heartening to see that a lot of people showed sympathy for American Muslims that we may not have thought would have showed that kind of sympathy.
Haroon Mogul is a senior correspondent at Religion Dispatches magazine. He is a fellow at Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. He's an author. He's a public speaker whose work appears on CNN, Salon, Al Jazeera. And I appreciate so much you being willing to sit down with us today and educate us further on how to move toward a better day in this whole tension.
Sure. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be on.
The report from Pew Research is titled America's Changing Religious Landscape. As we continue our examination of what this means for various communities in our nation, I wanted to consider the members of groups defined by both faith and culture. And I don't know anybody better to help in that regard than have Rabbi Jack Moline, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance, join us again on State of Belief Radio for that discussion. Jack, welcome back, and thank you for doing this.
Always a pleasure to be talking with you, Elton.
How do you see the religious landscape changing from a Jewish perspective?
Actually, I see the religious landscape becoming more familiar to American Jews than it may have been in the past. And it's only been in the United States that Jews have been considered primarily a faith community. Our long history is one as a people, as what I hesitate to call a nation, because it has different connotations today than it did in biblical times. When we often refer to ourselves as members of the tribe, perhaps that's a more accurate description. And what the Pew Report has indicated is that more and more Americans feel themselves to be part of a community with a faith overlay than a faith that has a community overlay.
Make the distinctions between cultural and religious affinities as you see them?
Well, I think there's a certain purposefulness about religious identity that requires people to be mindful and intentional about the actions they take in the service of their faith commitments. So a person of religious faith will make a point of worship, meditation, or reflection, whatever that faith tradition commends. They'll live by a calendar that is governed by something that is identified with their faith tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people who are cultural in their orientation will wear their identity like a pair of comfortable old jeans. It just seems to be the natural environment in which they operate and requires less intentionality. I imagine that sounds pretty good to a lot of Americans who are not too excited about devoting time and thought to how they're going to live their religious lives. On the other hand, it means that without that intentionality, without that serious focus, it's hard for the teachings of a faith to penetrate beyond the familiar tropes of a culture.
Jack, as a rabbi, how much does it matter to you whether a Jew is a Jew by cultural definition or by religious definition?
Well, here I am, Welton, in my 60s, and I'm giving you what I am aware is a very different answer than I would have when I was in my 30s. The lessons of Jewish self-identification in this country have been that as a rabbi, I need to be much more welcoming of people as they understand themselves than as I would like them to be understood from my definitions. So I have a sense of, I don't want to say necessarily affinity, but common purpose with people who identify as Jews, no matter how they identify.
Mm-hmm.
Although I feel a much closer spiritual connection with Jews who practice Judaism closer to the way that I do.
Mm-hmm. Jack, I'm also curious if you see a parallel to this phenomenon in the recent vote in support of marriage equality in Ireland. It's widely recognized as an overwhelmingly Roman Catholic country, but some commentators have referred to cultural Catholics in the wave of the vote there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think we're seeing a lot of writing on this right now, Welton, and a lot of people who are reflecting on whether there is a distinction between being faithfully identified and culturally identified. And when I say faithfully identified, I don't mean to imply that people who are culturally identified are not people of faith, but I think there are some people who would identify themselves primarily as believers and others who would identify themselves primarily as participants. And I think that around the world, including in places that we might be surprised, there is a larger and larger understanding that it is possible to be a participant in a wide culture that includes some of your faith commitments, and that can be separated from what your deeply held beliefs are.
You know, I was really surprised by a comment that I read from the Archbishop of Dublin. He spoke out frequently against marriage equality, but was careful to emphasize respect for LGBT people. Here's what he said, and I'm quoting, "Anybody who doesn't show love towards gay and lesbian people is insulting God. They are not just homophobic if they do that. They're actually godophobic because God loves every one of those people." That's different. I mean, that's not what I heard growing up as a Baptist. How religious rhetoric gets expressed in our country these days might learn something from that guy.
Well, you know, Welton, you and I are both old enough to remember when homosexuality was considered such a deficit that someone could be drummed out of the United States government on the presumption that they could be blackmailed with that information. And I have to credit loud and proud people who are out in insisting that there was absolutely nothing that was less than about them to the rest of us in the straight community. And I think that knowing face-to-face people who have differing orientations has made a cultural difference for people all over the world. Now, I know that there are still probably folks, particularly in more Orthodox traditions, who are struggling with whether the practice of homosexual love is something that is consistent with their religious beliefs. But I think what you've heard from the cleric in Ireland is an understanding that almost universally we now understand that sexuality exists on a continuum of some sort, and that it has absolutely nothing to do with the worth or the value or the spiritual rectitude of an individual who is a child of God.
Mm-hmm. Pew Research says that organized religion in America is declining. How significant do you think the culture war politicization that started with the moral majority back in the 80s has been in causing this shift?
Well, you and I were there at the beginning of these culture wars, Welton, and I'm a little distressed to see them cranking up again with Republican candidates making the pilgrimage to Jerry Falwell's university to reaffirm the values that he had promoted in his lifetime. I think that if there's anything that people on the far right of religion have learned, it is that they are not going to catch flies with vinegar. And they have driven away people who are looking for meaning in their lives by demanding uniformity rather than engagement. And I think we've seen the rebellion in the results of the Pew studies, and I think we've also seen the rebellion in the emergence of some extraordinary communities of progressive evangelicals who have rejected the notion of a strict conformity and replaced it with a desire to do God's will as they understand it, which means, first and foremost, loving every child of God. Hmm. Maybe it's because I'm a rabbi, but I still think there is a great spiritual awakening that is yet to come in America, but it is going to be as unexpected as the spiritual awakening of the 19th century was. I think that it is going to come from an unanticipated location, and if I knew what it was, I'd be standing there waiting for it.
Yeah. Jack, tell us one of the two best things that's going on at the Interfaith Alliance right now.
Well, you did us the big favor last week of having our dear friend Mitchell Gold on the show, who talked about the Everyone Only campaign that his company, Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, has embraced. That's been getting a tremendous amount of wonderful notice around the country, and I think has made the point that, as Mitchell said, being open to everyone is good for business. So we're still pursuing that and pursuing our engagement with issues of equality, both marriage equality and human equality. And I'm actually going to be speaking at the Islamic Society of North America. They're having a public policy conference in the Washington, D.C. area. And so we continue our outreach to religious minorities in the United States, just as you as a Baptist minister gained a certain entree and credibility by speaking against type when you sat in my chair and spoke to all sorts of groups. I am just absolutely delighted as a rabbi to be invited to address Muslims and to build some of those bridges there. Those are the kinds of things we continue to do.
Jack Moline is executive director of Interfaith Alliance, a writer, speaker, and congregational rabbi. Jack, as always, thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
I look forward to being with you again, and I promise to dress up better next time.
It would be easy to pile on the celebrity-driven story of covered-up sexual abuse within the prominent Duggar family of reality television's 19 Kids and Counting fame, but that would be both unpleasant and pointless. However, this sad story does give us the opportunity to re-examine how this extreme lifestyle of secrecy and control can open the door to abuse and victim blaming. Joining me right now is Vicki Garrison, who is a survivor of many years of quiverful family life, and today provides a resource for other survivors at her Patheos blog titled No Longer Quivering. Vicki, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What were you feeling as you watched this long hidden story break publicly?
I feel like it is heartbreaking. It's tragic. It's not in any way shocking to me. I didn't think, oh, wow, I can't even believe that happened. I'm actually surprised that, you know, this hasn't come to light sooner. Hmm.
Are there things about the Duggars' purportedly religious lifestyle that you see as increasing the risk of abuse?
I do. I think, number one, just the sheer number of children makes it very difficult to supervise, to properly attend to and raise these children, because it's one thing to birth them, you know, to reproduce like rabbits. It's another thing to actually raise your children, to be able to focus enough on what's going on with your children, to know them well enough to be able to catch things like this. And in the Duggar family, at the time that this happened, according to reports, was around 2002, 2003, Michelle would have had 14 children ages 14 and under. And in the midst of that, she's got her own health issues to deal with. She's, you know, she's got to be exhausted from having so many children in such a short time. And just to be able to keep up with the logistics and the organization and the, you know, the daily life, chores, and et cetera, let alone really being able to pay attention individually to your children, it's just a setup right there. But there's more. You know, there's these teachings within Quiverful that are very central, and one of them is patriarchy, the idea that women are basically created for the purpose of serving their men. They're there as helpmeets. They're there to do whatever they can to make the man's success in his work that God has given him. You know, the teaching is that God has given a mission to the man, and his family is there to support him and to help him to fulfill that. And so there's this idea that, you know, women are very much objectified and very much treated as they're for the man. And so that is going to be playing within the mindset. And then there's this emphasis on modesty, on the idea that women's bodies, female bodies, are just this irresistible temptation to men and to boys. And, you know, that's why they have to be covered completely, and they have to be very careful not to in any way defraud. That's a word that the Duggars use often. You don't want to defraud your brother. And they even have showed them on the program where they're out in public and the older girls will spot another female who is not covered enough. Maybe she's wearing shorts or a halter top or whatever. And they'll shout out Nike, which is a signal for the boys to look down at their shoes, to avert their eyes so that they won't be tempted by the female body. And so you can see where there's so much in that situation where things are just dysfunctional. They are not healthy relational concepts, and it can lead to a lot of abuse.
Just in case we have listeners that don't understand the mission of the Quiverful movement.
The premise of Quiverful, the basic idea there is that children are an unmitigated blessing from God. That comes from a Bible verse in Psalm 127, which says, children are a blessing from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward. Like arrows in the hands of a mighty man, so are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who has his quiver full of them. And there's always this emphasis on spiritual warfare, that it's a spiritual warfare, but that whole militant concept is foremost within the Quiverful ideology. And what they're doing is they're saying, you know, we are going to birth these arrows and sharpen them and use the skill to basically take over, outpopulate the ungodly, the secular population. This idea of catching this vision, this vision of God's plan for taking back America for God, and it is mainly an American phenomenon, although it is spreading. I've seen groups in Australia, in the UK, in Germany. It's growing around the world, but it's mostly been focused in America, and it's very much a theonomist kind of, we're going to take back America for God, we're going to create a godly society for Jesus.
You've seen a lot of these families, so what would be the dynamics typically between the children in the family?
It's a little harder for me to speak for the children because I do work with a lot of the kids, they're young adults now, who have grown up in this movement, and I've realized that I just can't quite get their perspective, having been the mom in the situation. Mm-hmm. But from what they've told me, basically they're born with their whole life already laid out, pre-planned, chapter and verse for what God wants for them to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. And so they're born with this idea that they have this mission, that this is their purpose. If they want to please God, they need to follow this path. Especially in the large Quiverful families, there is this tendency to parentify the children because it is such a harsh, demanding lifestyle. And to be able to keep up with a large-sized family, the moms have got to rely on those older children. Mm-hmm. They need to be their helpers. They need to be in there working along with them. And the Duggars, they often talk about the buddy system that they have in place mm-hmm. where, you know, as soon as a new one is born, they're paired up with one of the older children, and that older child is their buddy who is responsible for the daily care, you know, as far as making sure that they're eating right, getting them dressed, bedtime routines, all of these kind of things are actually the responsibility of the older children. And so when you've got a child, you know, because they're minor children, they might be a little older, a little more mature, but they're still children, and they are, you know, basically responsible for their younger sibling. You know, we call them sister moms. They're raising their younger siblings, and so the dynamic is really messed up. It's very confusing, and it's very unfair to these older children to have to raise their younger siblings.
And Vicki, apparently there were church members who were aware of what happened with the Duggar's oldest son involving his younger sisters. Did it surprise you to hear that they participated in the cover-up?
It does not surprise me, because within fundamentalist Christianity, there is this idea of, you know, God's channels of authority, the way that you are to deal with a brother who sins. First of all, it needs to be handled within the family. And, you know, the dad being basically responsible for whatever is going on in his own home. And so, first of all, they're going to handle it just within the family themselves. And if they feel like they need outside help, then biblically they would need to go to the elders of their church, which Jim Bob did. But then even, you know, within the church, they have this idea that it's a spiritual issue. It doesn't really occur to people in this fundamentalist mindset that, no, this is actually a legal issue. Mm-hmm. This is actually a crime. They're saying, well, this is a sin problem. And so they're going to look at spiritual means of addressing the situation.
In a male-dominated, authoritarian, and isolated environment like this, what can a victim do to get help?
It's very difficult. And the situations that I am familiar with, it has, you know, nearly always been that somebody from the outside who hasn't quite bought into this full-fledged fundamentalist mindset, they're the ones who see a problem and they go and intervene and get some help. Otherwise, it is very difficult because they are so isolated. They have no resources.
Knowing what you know about the dynamics of this kind of family, how do you see this playing out? Not on screen, but how do you see it playing out in this family? How would you expect this to get resolved?
Well, I mean, unless they are willing to just actually confront reality, they are living in an alternate universe in their heads, in which everything is spiritualized. Everything has to be filtered and interpreted according to ultimate eternal consequences. They're already doing this when Jim Bob and Michelle released a statement on their Facebook page. They said that, you know, this is something that has drawn their whole family closer to God. And so God is using this, and they're saying, you know, we hope that this turns out to be a testimony and that the world who is looking on, that you will all see the kindness of God because he brought us through even in really difficult circumstances. So, you know, there's just a lot of rationalization. There's a lot of disconnect. It's very difficult to see that, you know, unless some major switch finally goes on in Jim, Bob, and Michelle's head, they're just going to continue in this same kind of not really confronting the actual issue because they're too busy dealing with the spiritual realm in their heads.
Vicki Garrison spent many years in a fundamentalist quiverful family before freeing herself. Today she blogs at No Longer Quivering at Patheos and works to help other survivors of this extreme fundamentalist model of family. And I thank you for making time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Now, before we go, every time we take a step toward equality in this country, be it in terms of marriage or anti-discrimination ordinances or any number of other things, the bias block of the religious right continues to scaremonger and fundraise around wild scenarios of assaults on Christianity. Perhaps most crass have been the likes of Family Research Council President Tony Perkins, drawing parallels between the alleged coming restrictions on the faith in America and the very real, terrifying, and deadly attacks on Christians overseas. But as long as extremist words don't have consequences, perhaps extremists can be forgiven for using them. But what about when there are consequences? This past week in Connecticut, a Christian pastor was setting out little American flags on his church's property early on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend when he was shot 3 times. As the Reverend Augustus Seeley lay in his hospital bed, Hartford police released the following statement, I'm quoting, "Some language used in the incident and given where it was in front of a church known to be accepting of our LGBT community, it led us to have concern that this is a hate crime." End quote. If the police are right, it would be hard not to see this as a genuine attack on Christianity. Now, you may say this is one random incident, and that preliminary speculation doesn't a proof of motivation make. But just the week before, in Fountain Hills, Arizona, pastors of 8 Protestant churches ganged up to publicly condemn the progressive Christianity of United Methodist, the Fountains Church. They even bought newspaper ads. What kind of heretical goings-on are these Christians so up in arms about? Well, Fountains Church does welcome LGBT people of faith. It also shares its space with a synagogue and Buddhist center and regularly hosts events in partnership with the local Muslim community. Ample proof, I guess, that Fountains Church just doesn't get Christianity. But still, I would go so far as to call this ridiculous campaign an attack on Christianity. And what about Mill Valley, California? The local United Methodist Church displayed the following message on its signboard. "Jesus had 2 dads, and he turned out just fine." Provocative? Of course. But vandals quickly painted over the 2 dads part of the sign, censoring this pro-gay message. "We send best wishes for a full recovery to the Reverend Seeley in Hartford. We also celebrate the fact that despite concerted allegedly Christian attacks, the Fountains Church is about to break ground for the new building necessitated by the rapid growth of its membership." But as theocrats and even some prominent presidential candidates blather on about the threat basic human rights for everyone pose to their particular brand of fundamentalist Christianity, it's worth noting that real attacks are happening. Granted, they are not comparable to the horrors faced by people of various faiths in other countries. But they are also not necessarily disconnected from the verbal assaults on inclusive progressive faith these loudmouth conservatives seem compelled to continue. Oh, and as for that church in Mill Valley? A squad of Boy Scouts quickly turned up to clean the vandalized signboard, and the fresh new message now reads, "All welcome, vandals too." And just one more thing. This weekend marks the end of a long and productive tenure for our friend Kevin Ekstrom, who made an invaluable contribution to religious journalism at Religion News Service for 15 years and where he served as editor-in-chief since 2006. Across the years, we have called on Kevin countless times to provide perspective, insights, and commentary on the most important news stories of the day. And despite his many responsibilities, he has never refused. In fact, Kevin graciously guest-hosted State of Belief last year, and his end-of-the-year news roundups have long been an annual tradition around here. As Kevin moves into his new position as communications officer at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., I know he will contribute to the growth of an institution that has become so important to not just the spiritual, but the civic life of our nation's capital and beyond. It is no overstatement to say that this move will impact how we produce the show. But we will continue to rely on Religion News Service as readers and journalists have for 80 years now. And we'll certainly have Kevin on with us again soon in his new capacity. But for right now, let me say with absolute sincerity, congratulations, good luck, and most of all, Kevin, thank you. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to express my sincere gratitude. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, I urge you to join us and our other generous supporters. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends so they can be a part of this conversation as well. We really do need you. We need you to help spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.